From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the role social media plays on Election Day.
With social media, you have this incredible ability to target voters on a much more individual level than you do in traditional campaigns. And campaigns are, of course, taking advantage of that.
Confronting the question, are poor black Detroiters being left behind in the city's reinvention?
This is a discussion we need to have. There's no reason to hide from this. This hasn't been handled well in other areas. Let's try to make Detroit better.
And art prize pieces find a home with Ripley's Believe It or Not.
If I can find a piece of art in a town in Michigan and their reaction is going to be, wow, did you see that? Then I'm going to buy it.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It is here at last. Time for you to speak. Election Day 2014 is here. State Supreme Court races, an open Senate seat, a race for governor, and so much more. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we'll look at the role social media plays on Election Day. Plus, Macomb County residents serving jury duty will soon be paid in cash on the spot. We'll hear more about that in 20 minutes. But first, to a mailbox near you. Amidst all the campaign mailers from all the different candidates, some folks in Michigan, including some of our Stateside team, got something a little different. A postcard telling you whether you voted in a previous election and which of your neighbors did vote. A little peer pressure to rustle up more voters, perhaps? Political consultant Mark Grebner is with us now. Mark, just where are these flyers coming from?
It's a tactic that I invented about 12 years ago. And I was involved with a couple of faculty members at Yale University testing how effective it was compared to other methods of encouraging voting. And it turned out to be so powerful that it has now spread all over the country so that the flyers that people are getting today, not a single one of them paid me any money or hired me as a consultant or anything. They just read the papers and they're all doing it really on their own. It's in the public domain and, it's one of these things that everybody can do it, and nobody has to pay royalties on it. I don't actually have any connection with any of these. I've even gotten one or two of them. So,
and you look at that and go, yeah, it was my idea.
Yeah, and all over the country, people are sending me whatever the local version of it is. I've gotten flyers and postcards and so on from Minnesota and South Carolina and California.
So psychologically, what's happening?
A lot of people fail to vote, and if you try to think about why they fail, we have a very simple, stupid idea, which is they've forgotten it's Election Day. And so if we try to tell people it's Election Day, it turns out that has no effect whatever on people, or virtually none, because nobody forgets it's Election Day. How in the world could you if you were a registered voter? You know, everybody's just hoping desperately to get through it without, you know, more than 10 more reminders that it's Election Day.
Yeah.
The reason people don't vote is much more complex, and it's different for different people. But one of the things that factors into it is the knowledge of everybody that nobody knows if you vote. And it turns out that roughly 10% of the public tells pollsters, for example, that they always vote. But if you look up their records, they don't. So it occurred to me that what's happening is that people have discovered that just as, for example, in Ingham County, if you don't license your dog, nobody comes by and gives you a ticket for an unlicensed dog. So pretty soon people realize that licensing your dog is voluntary. It's up to you. Well, voting is voluntary. I mean, you can say you vote. You can talk about your political opinions. You know, you can act like you're a solid voter. And you just don't bother taking that 15 minutes or half an hour, which is what it really takes. It's something, it's some time you can save. And about 10% of the public has figured that out and uses it as just a little dodge. So this technique undermines that by scaring them with the idea that whether you vote or not is actually a public event, that your neighbors know it, that you know whether your neighbors vote. And it was an extremely effective motivator compared to other tactics, 5, 10, maybe even 20 times more powerful than the other messages that have been tried.
It's really interesting. I'm looking at one of these postcards that one of our staffers got from something called the Michigan Voter Project. So there's nothing about any candidate. You have no idea who it is. There's no website, because we looked it up, saying the Michigan Voter Project. But It tells him, according to the Secretary of State's records, you didn't vote in the August primary election this year. By the way, he did, so he was a little disconcerted to read this that he didn't. But here's, I just found this paragraph interesting. Because we keep track of every individual voter, when you skip an election, we worry it could become a habit, a bad habit we want you to break. We'll be looking for you at the polls Tuesday. Is it just me, or does this kind of smack of Big Brother watching me or a nanny scolding me?
Well, it does. It does, but you notice that you can't trace it, and so you can't vote against whoever did it. So if that pressures you or whoever received it to go vote, then they're ahead and they're not behind. That's why a candidate who did that, you know, you might blame them for Big Brotherism, but you can't blame the Michigan Voter Project, which, by the way, is one of the names that I filed. I mean, I think somebody's using my name, and that's my language in that postcard. Lordy, they ought to pay me for that.
Let me ask you this. How does this actually get assembled? How does Campaign X or whomever get my name and find out whether or not I voted? You just go to the Secretary of State's office? Or, I mean, what's the mechanics of this?
The way that we vote is actually based on what was discovered to work back in the 1880s and 1890s when the secret ballot was introduced in Michigan. And one of the pieces of that was that whether you vote or not has to be public record in order to prevent people from, for example, voting fraudulently. So it's necessary for campaigns and officials and even the public to be able to look somebody up a year later and see if they were on the rolls or not, so that it can be confirmed whether they were alive and living in the right area and so forth, and whether you could check your own voter record. Now, at this point, the way you get that record, it used to be quite difficult. You could go look at the paper record in the courthouse 100 years ago. But today, for about $25, the Secretary of State will sell you a file which has 7 million names on it and has essentially every voter in the state and whether they voted in each election. You can get it. Everybody can get it. It's very public.
Interesting, interesting stuff. And as you say, you found research has backed up this claim that it does move the needle and gets people into the voting booth.
Turnout dropped dramatically about 140 years ago, about 1870, when the secret ballot was introduced. Because in the good old days, it wasn't just whether you voted, it was how you voted that was public. Because you went and voted even out loud, sometimes in writing, but sometimes you actually spoke your candidate preferences in front of the election judges. And there'd be a crowd at the polls, and they'd cheer and they'd boo. There were fist fights at the polls. There were a lot of times the polling place was in a saloon, and so it was just kind of a natural part of elections to drink. But because everybody knew how you voted and how you were going to vote, they could actually round up their voters, deliver them to the polls, watch them all vote, and take them home. It's kind of a funny fact. One of the reasons that people resisted female suffrage was because voting in the 1870s and before was very similar to a fist fight, except more organized. And it was thought that women really couldn't participate in this kind of a bloody, drunken brawl. Secrecy of the ballot kind of civilized and brought about the system we have today. But at the same time, that dramatically reduced turnout because elections ceased to be a public event and became a private event. So what my idea was to partially return this to the public sphere so that you would almost think that you voted in the view of your neighbors. Yeah. I kind of think of it the same as, say, recycling. One of the reasons that recycling programs are effective is because you put your bin out there on the curb and people can see, your neighbors can see, whether you recycle or not. You know, if recycling were completely secret, in other words, you have to take it to a recycling center, then participation is quite a bit lower. But where recycling is done as a public process, like a ceremony, well, that raises participation.
And the same goes with voting. Mark, really, really, really interesting putting history together and kind of connecting the dots and showing us how this tactic you came up with gives a creative use of a little peer pressure to get people in to vote. Mark, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Mark Rebner is a political consultant. When you cast your vote today, you're not only doing something good for our democracy, you're doing something good for your health. That's not just opinion. It's backed up by science.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive! It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
Mark Zimmerman is a psychologist and a professor at the University of Michigan. Mark, what's going on here?
Well, I mostly study kids, and what we know about adolescents is that civic engagement has positive outcomes for their engagement with other people. They learn how to be involved with people without being violent, or they use alternative behaviors other than drug use. And so the engagement basically gives them alternative ways of focusing their energy. So it's helpful in that it gives us a sense of control and helps us avoid sort of other bad behaviors we might be engaged in.
So it's good for us to have that sense of social ties.
Yes. That's the other part of civic engagement and social ties, is that you develop a sense of connectedness with other people, and that is also very helpful for your overall health.
And I do get the feeling, as you just kind of read comments and letters to the editor or comments at the end of a news story, that so often people feel like their voice doesn't matter. But this is the place where it really does.
Well, it matters on a lot of levels. I mean, you know, on the one level, voting matters. But lots of researchers have found that having voice in decision making not only helps you feel better about the decision that's made, whether it's one you agree with or not, you feel like, again, that sense of control and that sense of influence and that sense of efficacy, which have been all associated pretty consistently with better healthy outcomes, better coping with stress, better dealing with interactions with other people, and you feel better about yourself.
And while we're doing this, if we've got kids and we bring them with us to the polling place, we're also setting a great example, aren't we?
That's true. We model positive behaviors, and as adults, anytime we can model a positive behavior for our children, that's a good thing. That's a good thing for their development. And voting is one of those. Voting also gets people engaging, thinking critically about their world and analyzing issues, and all of those things help model for their children decision-making and engagement.
Did you get a chance to vote today?
I actually, yes, but I voted earlier. I did an absentee ballot.
I did as well, and I have to say it was I love that. I think it took me about 45 minutes. I was researching and looking, and I totally agree. I felt great while I did it.
Yeah, I agree. And I always feel like, does my one vote matter? You know, yes and no, but if we all had that attitude, then nobody would ever vote. It's the sum of the parts that matter. And, yeah, I always feel good that I've at least had my say. I mean, that's what democracy is all about.
Mark, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Mark Zimmerman is a psychologist and a professor at the University of Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is National Adoption Month. That nationwide focus on adoption can cause anyone in the birth triad to do some extra reflecting, whether birth parent, adoptive parent, or adoptee. Zeke Anders is an adoptee who grew up in Dearborn. He's now a filmmaker in Los Angeles. Zeke has shared his adoption journey through a vlog, a video blog he calls American Soul, as in Seoul, South Korea, where he was born. Zeke Anders is with us now here. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I want to start with some full disclosure. I am an adoptee, although your adoption experience centered around having been born in Korea and then growing up as basically the only Asian kid at your very, very white Dearborn schools and neighborhood. I was adopted at 7 weeks old and raised by a family in Ferndale.
Okay.
And grew up with a lot of the very same questions you phrased. I think there's a lot of commonalities in the experience that we adoptees have. As you look around at your family and no one looks like you, That's a big start right there. Whether you're from Korea or whether, as it turned out, you're from just a few mere miles away, because I did find my birth mother. But tell us a little of your story. Most of us have just the tiniest little scraps of hints about our roots. You have even less. You don't even know your birth date.
Exactly. It's a best guesstimate. And, you know, I was adopted, I think, in Busan. And that's only because, actually, just being back in Michigan, I went up into the attic and found all these old papers that my mother had kept. And I found a hospital, like, record sheet, and it said from Busan. So, and I was adopted when I was about 3, came to O'Hare in Chicago. And that's really all I know, you know, nothing prior from that. So,
tell me about your adoptive family.
They were, they were a white American couple. Really, really wonderful people. I mean, and I'm not just saying that because they're my parents, but they really were. They loved me unconditionally. They were also very religious. My mother was a PK, which is a pastor's kid. It was maybe a little too much for me, but, you know, I can't complain, because, I mean, they provided me a, you know, with a wonderful life.
And it was nurturing and loving.
Absolutely.
And being in Dearborn, especially this, we're talking in the 70s.
Yes.
Very Caucasian. Let's just put that mildly.
Exactly.
But you talk in your vlog that you weren't especially aware of being the only Asian kid at the school. In fact, even your friends weren't.
Right. You know, living inside my own body, growing up, I didn't feel, you know, excluded necessarily. Now, you know, when I would meet new people and you know, new kids and friends on the playground, of course, their perception is, you look different. Who are you? And there's this awkward sort of moment of trying to figure out each other and how we fit together. But personally inside, you know, I was just like everybody else. And that's, again, because I was growing up in a white family and just very Americanized.
You're not just telling your story. You are inviting. You are really opening the door. Please let me know your thoughts. You want to get a dialogue going.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things with vlogging and just, I think, in today's social media world, it's not just a platform for someone to just speak. It's also a platform for interaction and opening up dialogue, as you said. And, you know, again, one of the reasons why I also made this was to sort of bring out adoption to the forefront of people's minds. And, you know, there's a lot of stigma that's still attached to adoption. And I think the more that, you know, you can educate people and just, bring to light, I think it helps overall.
Put a face on adoption.
Exactly.
You work as you challenge adoptees to share their thoughts and opinions, and you ask questions, a series of questions. And one of those was, what annoys you? And your answer to your own question absolutely blew me away, because you said that people say what when they hear you're adopted?
I'm sorry.
I was blown away. I've never, ever, ever heard that. Where do you think that comes from?
I don't know. And that's, you know, that's the most common. I mean, I get a lot of answers, but that's the one that's the most common. And I don't necessarily think they mean it the way it sounds.
Wow.
It's still a little annoying.
Yeah.
But I don't know where it comes from. I think they just feel very saddened that I did not grow up perhaps with my biological family, or, you know, in my own country, or
maybe that's the difference,
yeah,
between you having come from Korea, that somehow they're sensing that separateness where I didn't.
Right.
But yeah, that was something. I also love this question you posed. Give me a perk about being adopted. What'd you hear from people?
I heard a lot of we're different, we stand out. I heard one comment said, which I thought it was really interesting, it made me become more independent as a person.
I know one thing that you could say is, when you see things in your family or members of your family that are kind of wacky, and you can kind of say to yourself, well,
yeah.
Nature nurture here.
Right. Someone did say, which was sort of a lot of adoptees feel that, you know, they want to find their biological parents, and they want to find their history because of their whole genetic history. And one person made a comment about a perk, saying, I'm glad I don't know. Mm. That, you know what, I'm just here, I'll just live my life as healthy as I can and not have any of that genetic history of worry. So
now, you never did make any effort to find your birth parents.
No.
Why is that?
It just never really was a void. It never really, you know, mattered really. And part of it is because I think my parents are the parents that I've always known. But yeah, it was just never a need. I mean, now that I'm older, it's, you know, I could, and I, you know, out of curiosity, I might try to find, you know, any history. But
I debated with it for years and years and years and years, and finally in my 50s,
mm-hmm,
I did the search through the adoption agency, and I did find my birth mother. And my whole reason was, I wanted to say thank you,
yeah,
and reassure her that all was well.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking for a new mom and that, but it was, and it was pretty amazing to see someone whose face echoed mine.
Yeah.
First time in my life. And that was pretty powerful, I will have to say. I'm wondering what reactions, Zeke, to your vlog have maybe touched you the most.
I mean, there's been so much feedback, and people have just reached out to me, not just on like YouTube, but I mean, just personally on you know, emails and correspondence, and you know, they've expressed how similar our stories are, and you know, I'm not alone, because I think, you know, growing up, there's this tendency to feel like I'm alone and I'm vulnerable and I don't have a place to fit. And that's really encouraging and you know, just heartwarming to know that, yeah, there's a whole group of us and we can act as a support group to one another.
I have known adoptees who, for whatever reason, kind of grew up with a chip on their shoulder about having been adopted. And you're shaking your head like that does ring bells.
Yeah. It's funny because out of my vlog, I've come to realize that I've been labeled as a happy adoptee. So
that's interesting.
And you know, I'm not ashamed of that. You know, I mean, I had a great childhood and, again, a family who loved me unconditionally. But, you know, on the flip side, yes, there are adoptees out there that, you know, have had obstacles and tribulations. And for their own, you know, solid reasons, they need to figure things out or they need to, you know, deal with and cope with their issues. So.
Now, I know you tell us in your vlog how your mom passed away when you were just 17, so you weren't even out of high school. How about your dad?
Passed away in 2008.
Okay. So did that, you think, give you kind of a license, if you will, or a sense of freedom to really express feelings that maybe you would have kept hidden until had they been around to watch?
I think you're right. I was always a little guarded with my feelings, and maybe that's attributed to being adopted and just growing up in an interracial family. I know when my mother passed away, obviously that was hard, being also a teenager, and it made me have to grow up a little sooner. Even then, I was starting to sort of reach in and sort of express my personal feelings at that point. I think when my father passed away, that was sort of like, it felt weird because it was like I was an orphan again.
Which we all feel when that happens.
Yeah. And so I think at that point, I was like, yeah, it was like, well, what do I have to lose now? I might as well just sort of let it all out and just let the chips fall where they may.
It's easy to watch. It's five installments that will not take a lot of time, but will get you really thinking. Zeke Anders' vlog is called American Soul, and you can find it on his website, ZEKEANDERS.com, ZekeAnders.com. It was great to meet you and talk with you, Zeke. Thank you
so much. Thank you.
We've all heard about new businesses and entrepreneurs seeking Detroit out and so-called urban pioneers moving to Detroit, bringing their money, their lifestyles, their bistros and bars. My next guest wonders, will Detroit's new future include the people who've been struggling along in Detroit neighborhoods year after year, people who are poor and largely Black? Suzette Hackney's commentary, Is There Room for Black People in the New Detroit?, was published in Politico magazine. Suzette Hackney is with us now. Thank you so much for joining us, Suzette.
Happy to be here.
You are now an editorial writer and columnist for The Blade in Toledo, but you covered Detroit City Hall, Detroit's neighborhoods and crime for the Detroit Free Press from the mid-90s to 2012. So you know the city, but now you have some new perspective. What are you seeing that's troubling you?
Well, I left the city 2 years ago to accept a fellowship at the University of Michigan, and then I got a new job in Toledo. But I am in Detroit very often. I still own a home there. I have friends and family there, so it is definitely my home base. And I'm so excited about what I'm seeing in Detroit with all the new developments that are occurring there, restaurants and, as you said, bars and boutiques and all kinds of interesting things happening in the city, but I'm not seeing much of this trickling into the neighborhoods. And these neighborhoods are where poor people live, where Black people live, and it's just concerning to me. I want everyone to get a piece of this pie, and I don't see it happening.
The way you put it in your piece, here's the quote, "The prospect is a city that's open for new business." When we see the kinds of signs of reinvestment and revitalization, whether it's Dan Gilbert buying buildings downtown, new businesses like Shinola, new construction, whether it's office buildings or townhouses or lofts, does that not strengthen the city's tax base so it's just stronger all around and then able to improve life for people in the more outlying poorer neighborhoods?
It absolutely does improve the city overall. The city needs a tax base, and the city needs people to live in it and reinvest in it. And that is nothing but wonderful for the city. So I don't want my point to be misunderstood. People can come in irrespective of race, come live there. It's great for the city. My problem is that I don't see many policies
being discussed as far as, okay, how do we now make this a citywide revitalization?
You actually, in your piece for Politico, Suzette Hackney, you actually anticipated being hit with an accusation that you're race baiting, and you say no, and that is because?
I don't think you can talk about Detroit and Metro Detroit without talking about race. It is a very unique city because it is 83% African American. So if you're looking at this new urban pioneer movement, and that's predominantly white folks, younger folks moving into the city, and Detroit is not unique to this. This is happening in cities all across America. But then you still see there's a pocket, a huge pocket of Detroiters who are black, who happen to be black, and who are poor, and they're not feeling any of those opportunities.
I'm speaking with writer Suzette Hackney. Her commentary, Is There Room for Black People in the New Detroit?, has been published in Politico magazine. What kind of response have you gotten to the piece, Suzette?
Lots of social media response. Actually, I was floored at the number of people who sent me tweets about it, people who have found me here in Toledo and emailed me, and very positive response. People have said this is something, again, not unique to Detroit. It just happens to be happening in Detroit right now, but it's happened in your Brooklyns and all of your other cities. And people saying this is a discussion we need to have. There's no reason to hide from this. This hasn't been handled well in other areas. Let's try to make Detroit better. Let's try to make it different.
You write in your piece that you're not sure, in your words, the urgent message is being carried into most of the neighborhoods. Get on this train of resurgence right now or be left behind. And I'm wondering, who do you think should be carrying this message?
As I say in the piece, whose responsibility is it? Is it government's responsibility? Are there social services that should be doing this? I think it's a combination of all of that. Detroit has always been a place where churches have been active, where community groups have been active, and played a very significant role in how government works. Here is the opportunity, again, for all of those entities to come to the table, including entrepreneurs, including the Dan Gilberts of the world. So I think it's everyone's responsibility to do this.
And within the neighborhoods themselves, what needs to happen, do you think, you know, to help people who want it get themselves on the resurgence train?
Well, I do think the city is starting out correctly. I think that clearing up blight, making sure that streetlights work, making sure that police officers come when called, making sure that, you know, you can walk down a street and feel comfortable. Those are all huge issues that need to be addressed first. And I think that Mayor Mike Duggan is doing a great job doing that. But we can't ignore the education piece. And from what I understand, it seems like it's overwhelming to our elected officials. Bankruptcy does nothing to address the overhaul that Detroit Public Schools needs. Bankruptcy does nothing to address the need for there to be programs that are training the next generation so that they're employable.
What do you think the challenge is to these poor Detroiters that you're writing about as far as an initiative to get themselves on this resurgence train?
Detroiters have buried themselves in hopelessness. Detroiters definitely have some personal responsibility in this. There's a huge dropout rate. There's a huge illiteracy rate. There are people who would rather smoke marijuana than get up and go to work every day. There are people who are having children, more children than they can support. And I point this all out in my piece as well. And Detroit leaders have talked about this for years. There needs to be a cultural shift among Detroiters, a kind of get up and go. Let's do this. Let's do better than we have been doing. And someone, frankly, needs to be having that conversation with Detroiters as well.
Am I correct when I get the sense from reading your piece in Politico, Suzette, that you're not saying it's a bad thing to have, for example, middle-class young whites coming into Detroit and moving into lofts or moving into houses, setting up businesses. That's not a bad thing, but there's a piece of this big puzzle that just has not been addressed. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair. A thriving city needs all kinds of folks to live in it. And so, you know, of course, I understand how it works. I understand that there needs to be a tax base. There needs to be people reinvesting in Detroit, people moving back to Detroit, willing to live there. I don't care what color that is. And I think there's a piece that I say in there that the color I'm talking about is the color that we all want in our pocket, and that's green. That's really what matters here. And that's where I feel that Detroiters are not getting a piece of this. There's no conversation about them being able to maximize their opportunities and get a slice of that green as well.
Suzette Hackney, her piece, Is There Room for Black People in the New Detroit, can be found at Politico.com. Suzette, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you got up this morning and checked your Facebook feed, what'd you see? Probably a lot of status updates and photos and links exhorting everyone to find their polling location and get out and vote. And, of course, that goes along with all the stuff that friends on either side of the political spectrum have been posting now for weeks. Let's talk more about social media and our political process. Josh Pasek is with us. He's an assistant professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. Hey, Josh.
Hello. How are you doing?
Great. How important do you think social media has become in politics today?
Well, I think they're really taking on more and more of a role. With social media, you have this incredible ability to target voters on a much more individual level than you do in traditional campaigns. And campaigns are, of course, taking advantage of that.
And doing it in as people are sharing things, you're not paying a dime for someone to hit that share button and spread it around.
Exactly.
Who was the first big candidate to use social media in a big way?
Well, the first person to really push on this front was actually Howard Dean back in his primary election in 2004. And so Dean created all of these tools to help try to facilitate the people who were out, you know, interested in Dean well before the election, before he really had staff on the ground, to get them coordinated. And it was moderately successful until that famous Dean scream moment that many people will probably still remember.
First thing that came into my mind when you said Howard Dean was his barbaric yawp.
Yep, it was quite something. But that moment, you know, even though that moment really crashed his campaign, what he had shown in the course of that election was that social media was just an incredible environment for helping pass along information, for raising money and other things like that. And then a bunch of the social networking sites have more recently gotten in the act. And so if you open up Facebook today, my Facebook, for instance, has a button I can click that says, I'm a voter. They may well even be doing an experiment where they're trying to see whether different phrases that you could push on its election day have a different influence. So,
and what about for voters, do you think? How much, we've talked about the campaigns, what about voters and how much are they relying on social media to track political news?
Well, social media are a very good way to get political news into individuals' hands. Increasingly, I've at least, and I imagine most other people, have seen a lot of commercials that have been placed on either social media in the little sort of advertising sections or at the beginning of things like YouTube videos.
Yes.
And so that's a way of really targeting people because you know a bunch more about somebody that you're going to give that kind of advertising to than you would about, you know, a normal voter who you might do a television ad on. You have much less of a sense about. Then also you have this cool ability to, of course, have people share things themselves, to pass it on, and to make it a social environment. And that does the same in spades, in that you really get this social environment encouraging people to go do an activity. Because when you say, hey, all your friends are voting, you should too, that's a lot more effective than just saying, you should vote.
So, yeah, when you wake up and you see everybody's got, all right, everybody, let's get out and do this together. Now, that's talking about getting out and voting. I'm wondering, just based on what I've seen on my Facebook wall, if there are certain folks who can't resist a chance to slap something up pushing, you know, an anti-this or a pro-that viewpoint, political viewpoint. I find myself not wanting to see that on my Facebook wall. I don't unfriend, but I hide. I don't want to see it. Is that pretty common, do you think?
So we don't actually have any good numbers on quite how many people hide stuff off their Facebook feed. It's my guess that political information is one of the things that gets people to hide it a little more often, particularly if you disagree with the person who's sharing that information. But, you know, if, on the flip side of the coin, right, how many other opportunities are you going to have to really figure out what you should be doing in a particular school board race? Or something of the like. There just isn't a lot of great information there. And so if you want information, or if you're not seeing much else out in the environment, finding it on a Facebook feed is a pretty good way to go.
Do people, have we been able to prove it, do they actually get out and vote because of what they see on social media?
So the best evidence actually comes from Facebook themselves. And Facebook has done a series of experiments to see if, you know, telling people about the election and such makes a difference for whether people go vote. And a lot more people in the condition where you're told that your friends went out and voted are going to go out and do, in fact, go out and vote. So there's a lot of reason to believe it. Also, in a series of studies, one of which I did, we ended up looking at the extent to which people are civically engaged in doing political stuff in general and whether or not they use Facebook. And it turns out that the people who use Facebook tend to be a little more civically and politically engaged, sort of in line with that same narrative. So it does seem that social media really provides an important forum for political information in the contemporary era.
Well, let's pivot back to candidates and to politicians. There have to be occasions, and if we probably don't have to think too hard, where people have really made fools of themselves by you know, misstating something or tweeting something, putting some comment on Facebook, and having it blow up in their face.
I mean, it's a new medium, and one can definitely do a pretty dumb thing when you're broadcasting to an enormous audience without necessarily taking that much time to think. In sort of a classic line, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, once said that too many tweeters could make a twat. And I think that's sometimes right. I mean, we saw with things like Anthony Weiner's lovely picture that you can put something really dumb out there, and once you do, you're never going to get it back. But by and large, you know, there are a lot of people out there who know how to use this stuff pretty savvily and who aren't going to share questionable pictures on a site like Facebook and are going to recognize that it's another place where candidates can express their voice and get heard by a whole bunch of people.
Josh, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
No problem at all.
Josh Pasek is an assistant professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. The artists who display their works at Art Prize in Grand Rapids every year all have a shot at winning the top public or jury vote and the prize. But there's another possibility, the chance to sell your work to Ripley's Believe It or Not and have it wind up in one of their museums around the world. Edward Meyer is with us. He's VP of Exhibits and Archives for the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. So he has been buying art for Ripley's for three decades. Edward, just how important has Grand Rapids and Art Prize become to you as you travel everywhere looking for art?
Well, it's the number one art show, I'd say, in America. But certainly the number one art show for Ripley's, Believe It or Not. We've attended 5 out of the 6 years that it's been going on, and we bought art from the first year, even though we didn't get there personally. But, you know, for 6 years, we've managed to buy upwards to, 15 to 20 pieces every year. And the real important thing for me is not just the piece we actually buy at Art Prize, but meeting and establishing a relationship with the artists. And one guy in particular named Eric Daig, his piece back in the very first year, I believe, came in third. Well, we now own 11 pieces of art by him. So not just the one that was at Art Prize, but we've gone on to buy 10 more. And another gentleman, Bill Secunda, who is actually the very first artist who made us aware of Art Prize, and he's from Pennsylvania. We bought the piece that was displayed in the first year, and his sculptures are full-size animals made out of nails. But we now own about 15 of his pieces, and they're all over the world, everywhere from Canada to Korea and Mexico. And Bill has, become part of the Ripley family, and we not only owe that to Art Prize, but we owe him to Art Prize as the guy that first introduced us.
When you come, Art Prize or anywhere else, when you're looking for pieces for the museums, what is it you're looking for?
This year we had very specifics, but in general, we are looking for art made from unusual mediums. You know, we want the piece to be, you know, nice, presentable, beautiful, whatever adjective you want to use. But what's going to catch my eye, and it doesn't have to be one of the ones that wins the prize. We really don't care what the jury thinks. In fact, we often disagree with them totally. But we're looking for pieces made from unusual mediums, people that make stuff out of nails, out of laundry lint, out of toothpicks, the kinds of things that anybody could make, but most people would never think of it. And that, to us, is what makes it unbelievable, that somebody actually creates art sometimes it's recycled garbage, but just, you know, stuff that you don't expect art to be made from. Laundry lint being perhaps the absolute best example.
That is a great example. So what is your system? You come to Grand Rapids and you wear out the shoe leather?
That's exactly what we do. But as I was saying, this year we were specifically looking for 3D sculpture, preferably with some sort of interactivity movement to it. So we go online, particularly my assistant, Angela Johnson. She spends about a week before we get to Art Prize and goes through the entire web page and tries to find things that may or may not interest us. And this year we had 80 items identified. Then we went, Angela and I, for 3 days, and we pounded the pavement about 12 hours a day. In total, we saw over 1,300 pieces of art.
Wow.
But we saw 78 out of the 80 that we really wanted to see. So, you know, we won't go home until we've seen the list. It may take us months to actually buy it. Last year, we were still buying stuff into February. But, we, you know, we bought a couple pieces on site, and then we go home and, you know, try to negotiate a price and try to get, the, you know, because sometimes you see the artist at the show, but sometimes you don't. And over a couple months, we hope to get away with, you know, 15 to 20 items.
Edward, what is it about Art Prize in Grand Rapids that you think is just, as you say, you consider this like the number one art show? Why is that?
I think the prize money being so big is what attracts the quality. And then obviously it's the quality that attracts me. But I just love the way the town does it. And I don't necessarily agree with all the rules and regulations, but it is such a wonderful spirit. They have totally made art for people. I go to art shows all over the world, and there's a couple here in Florida specifically that are so snobbish that, you know, the average person will never buy a piece of art because they're scared to attend. Grand Rapids has, you know, with the docents, with the people on the street handing out maps, with the fact that the art is everywhere, you know, from pizza stores to out in the park, they've just made it a community event of the kind that you sort of dream about little towns doing. But Grand Rapids is a big city. It's not a little town by any means. And yet they've managed to pull off an event that the whole town is involved in.
Well, in fact, as I think about what they're doing,
it's a pretty place, too.
It is pretty. And I love the way you described it, Edward, as art for people. And it almost strikes me that Ripley's and Art Prize kind of share that mission of reaching out to folks and giving them something to kind of startle them or amaze them. So it seems like there is kind of a sense of shared mission.
Well, that's exactly what Ripley's is trying to do. Our brand new book is called Reality Shock, and I think that says it all. We are on a mission to wow people, and if I can find a piece of art in a town in Michigan that the rest of the world hasn't seen and their reaction is going to be, wow, did you see that, then I'm going to buy it.
Edward, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My privilege. Thanks for having us on.
Edward Meyer is the Vice President of Exhibits and Archives at the Ripley's Believe It or Not. Every year, tens of thousands of us are called to jury duty around the state. Some 19,000 people a year are called to duty in Macomb County Circuit Court. Soon, those jurors will find their experience a bit more convenient. That's because Macomb County jurors will soon be paid in cash, paid every day from an ATM instead of waiting weeks for a check. It's a first for Michigan. Carmela Sabaw is the Macomb County clerk. Tell us how this will work.
You know something, how it will work, where jurors are called, we have a one-day, one trial. So they're there for one day, they're there for a half a day, or they're there for a trial. So when they're done, you know, serving for a half a day, they will get paid $15. And if they serve a full day, they'll get $30. So once they're, you know, complete their service, they will go to the kiosk and put in their number, and they will be able to get their cash right there.
So you have happy jurors.
Happy jurors, and they can go out into the community. If they're there for a full day, they have money for their parking, for gas, for lunch, babysitting, shopping. And I think they're going to be happy because cash is king.
Cash is king. And, you know, I stop and I think about the fact, you know, instead of sitting home waiting for a check that you then have to take and go to the bank, you're able to walk up to a kiosk and walk out with cash in hand. And I'm sure from your point of view, you don't have a person tied up at some cash window doling out money. Let the machine do it.
Absolutely. They just have to scan their number in, and then they're able to be paid. And then they get a letter with that also, so that if their employer doesn't want them to keep that money, they have proof of their service.
Where'd the idea come from, Carmela?
You know something, I have incredible people that work for me. And Jenna Brewer, who has been with the jury room for probably the last year and a half, she has looked at our system, and she's just been looking all around to see. And we wanted to pay cash before she came here, and we weren't able to do it because the technology wasn't there with the kiosk. And to do the cards and all that, it just didn't seem that that would have been feasible. It would have been way more work. Now we have the armored cars that come take care of the money in the kiosk, so it's very safe.
And the kiosk, my understanding is it's the first in, you're the first county in Michigan to have these kiosks.
Yes, we are.
And I'm sure deep down, even a deeper thing with this is having people, sometimes people get a little grumbly when they get called for jury duty. I don't need to tell you that.
They do. And that's why, you know, here at Macomb County, we really try to make our jurors happy. And we, first of all, did that with the one day, one trial, because before I came here, and I've been here now 23 years, but before that, they had to be there for a whole week and sometimes longer. And so the one day, one trial, jurors like it a lot. The judges like it a lot, too. And we call in a lot more jurors. But when they know they only have to be there for one day or half a day, you know, it's easier to accept. And then we provide free wireless internet for them. So some people who are working, they can take their laptops in there and continue their work. And then we have other ATM machines in the jury room where they can scan their card to come in, and they check in that way. I have one person who handles that in my office. Prior to this, I used to have three people up there. So we are cost effective, and we have people who are happy. And we also did a bus service. Those people who could not, you know, have transportation down to the county building, they could get a bus pass. And also our library, if they call in to the library, they can get their book and have it delivered to the jury room the next day.
I've served on a jury. You've thought of a million great ways to just smooth out the bumps.
Honestly, it is true, because you are right. People, they're not happy when they're called to jury duty, but they pay attention to it. And we know it's a public service that they're doing, and we want to make it as convenient as possible.
Carmela Sabaugh, Macomb County Clerk. Carmela, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Today's State's Ed was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Zach Dieterman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.